This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
China's energy demand is going to continue to grow at such a rapid rate that even decades from now, 40 years from now, we're still going to see coal play a major role in China's energy consumption mix. And I think that's kind of where the whole argument that this golden age of natural gas can do wonders for China, just as it has here in the US, that argument kind of falls apart over there.
There's a relatively unanimous recognition that we inhabitants of Earth really need to break our addiction to coal. It's filthy and there are so many cleaner energy sources. This mantra is now being repeated all over coal-dependent China, where shale gas resources appear to be abundant. It turns out, however, that the transition away from coal may not be so simple, or even a step in the right direction. Mother Jones journalists Jaya Lee and James West spent a year investigating the ins and outs of the growing fracking industry in China. I caught up with them before a recent panel discussion in San Francisco to talk about how U.S. oil and gas interests are exporting fracking around the globe, and how the technology may pose risks in China that even exceed those associated with coal. Listen now to the first half of this two-part series on today's Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jaya Lee and James West. They both work for Mother Jones, and they have a recent piece entitled Deep Inside the Wild World of China's Fracking Boom. Jaya, James, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So in terms of natural gas and shale deposits, what kind of proven reserves is China reporting at this point to the global community? Is this akin to the U.S. deposits or not?
So according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, who have kind of forecasted deposit volumes around the world, China has the highest volume and surpasses that of the U.S.'s own resources. There's a bit of debate as to how much of that is economically viable in terms of extraction and how much of it they'll physically be able to access in China. Here in the U.S., we see a lot of extraction happening in flatlands. In China, the geology is very different. It's in very mountainous areas, and the geology of the shale formations is much more complicated than those that we've seen here in the States. So the actual... You know, it really depends on how you're defining reserves here in the U.S. and in China. The potential, though, is seen to be pretty great. How much of that in reality will be extracted, it's hard to say at this point.
From your piece, it sounds like a lot of the shale deposits are a little more harder to get. This is not the easy oil, so to speak. There's going to be tremendous amount of water used to try to extract these deposits, and that leads to one of the big resource concerns.
Right, exactly. So there are multiple aspects to the challenges that China faces in terms of developing its shale gas reserves. The foremost one, as both industry folks and environmental researchers see it, is the water, amount of water required to drill for shale gas. Some early estimates say that it's roughly twice that of what's required here in the U.S. But that's not the only challenge, right? As I was just saying, the road infrastructure getting to some of these very, very remote areas high up in the mountains is going to be logistically very challenging, and I think has already proven to be so at China's early fracking wells. Nonetheless, the Chinese government, and with encouragement from the U.S. government, still sees a lot of potential in this realm, and I think we'll continue to see companies at least attempting to extract even with these challenges at hand.
James, maybe you can speak to the evolution or the run-up to where we are now in terms of multinational corporations based largely in the U.S., these oil and gas interests like Halliburton and the ExxonMobils of the world, and China. Can you paint us a picture of what's been happening for the last 4 or 5 years? China Air has direct flights now from Beijing to Houston, which I found pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the relationship between China and the U.S. in terms of oil and gas cooperation at some of the highest levels of bilateral arrangements has been going for a couple of years now. But it's only very recently that the focus has turned to fracking as a potential technique to unlock these massive shale reserves that Jaya was talking about before. And so we got really kind of amazing exclusive access to one of these conferences where we saw top-level officials from the United States government talk to their counterparts and introduce some of these senior-level executives from these big companies that you were mentioning, you know, this sort of presenting a platter of American, corporate interest for the Chinese to grill about how it could be that they could frack these massive shale reserves. So we had a good insight into that and heard from the then ambassador to China, Gary Locke, really prioritize, it seemed to me, fracking as one way that China can really begin to think seriously about their air quality crisis, as well as climate change, which he mentioned specifically in front of all of these delegates to this conference in a city called Xi'an in the center of China.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jaya Lee and James West of Mother Jones. They have a piece in the recent Mother Jones issue on China and its fracking boom. So one of the takeaways that your piece reflected was that the talking points from these executives that you're referring to, James, were saying we got to get China off coal, and this is the best way. Obviously, these are not like the staunchest environmentalists, but what are their motives beyond just dollars? Do you think that there is some validity to looking at natural gas as a bridge for the Chinese with their seemingly endless demand for more and more energy at this point?
I think what you can say is that China is trying absolutely everything. You know, they're not just trying fracking as a bridge fuel to get off coal. They're also the world's leading investor in renewable energy, for example. And we also had the great fortune of touring a solar facility, the biggest in the world, operated by Yingli Solar outside of Beijing in a city called Baoding. So they're doing that as well. They're doing wind, they're doing solar. So I see this as part of a portfolio that they're trying to develop at a breakneck speed so that they can finally begin to transition off coal and they can finally see that peak, which the vice premier mentioned in front of the UN in New York the other day. He actually said that we may even be able to see as, quote, as soon as possible, the peak of our emissions in the next decade. So that's a remarkable thing for the Chinese to begin to achieve. And I think fracking is certainly not being sold or marketed by the Chinese as a silver bullet, but it's being seen potentially as a way that they can begin to reduce their emissions, clean up their act, and have a reliable, you know, albeit still fossil fuel source of energy as part of a renewable portfolio that, you know, can begin to get rid of coal in the long term. But certainly from what we saw, we're so far away from that happening.
Take up your child. Thank you.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jaya Lee and James West. They have a recent piece in Mother Jones on China and its fracking boom. Jaya, you say in the piece that you're a little skeptical over the variance between coal and natural gas, shale gas, and the emissions and the resources that are required to extract these deposits as well. Coal, for example, is twice as bad for the environment. I don't have the quote in front of me in terms of emissions as natural gas, but most of us think of coal as many, many times worse for the environment than natural gas. We think of natural gas. I just came from a clean energy summit in Nevada. Clean energy is a term that's been co-opted by the natural gas industry, it seemed like. Anytime we were talking about renewables, that's what I think of as clean energy. But when you hear that term clean energy, that includes natural gas in that portfolio.
That's right. So I think you raise a lot of good points there. In the U.S., the natural gas revolution has, putting all the negative consequences aside with water and whatever else have you, you know, it has lowered our carbon emissions, or so it seems. In China, I think we're looking at a bit of a different landscape. Burning coal has had such a visible and visceral kind of pollution and environmental consequence that, you know, anyone who's been to a large city in China will instantly be able to relate. And I think, you know, that's not just an environmental problem, but it's had a lot of political consequences as well. As China's urban middle class continues to grow, I think we're going to see an increasing number of, you know, not in my backyard type protests. And that's really ringing alarms for the higher ups in China's leadership. Earlier this year, I believe we saw one of China's top leaders declare war on air pollution. And PM2.5, which is not a well-known thing here in the States, is very much part of the public consciousness around air pollution. So it's very real. And I think that's kind of where the argument that we've seen here in the States before, that natural gas does burn at a cleaner rate in a cleaner way than coal does, can be quite persuasive. However, you know, based on James and my reporting on this issue, what we're seeing is that China's energy demand is going to continue to grow at such a rapid rate that even decades from now, 40 years from now, we're still going to see coal play a major role in China's energy consumption mix. And I think that's kind of where the whole argument that, you know, this golden age of natural gas is, you know, can do wonders for China as well as just as it has here in the U.S., that argument kind of falls apart over there. We're going to see an increasing rate of urbanization and energy demand. And I think, as James was saying earlier, that's going to mean more of everything. And I think that's the kind of overarching strategy here.
Did you get a sense that environmental concerns by a populace that has growing inequality, that the tipping point for social unrest could stem from ultimately the environmental movement?
I think it's going to stem from a lot of different issues. I mean, the environment is just really one facet of the kind of rising number of public protests that we're seeing in China. There's a lot of issues with access to healthcare and education and sort of other everyday practical problems that a lot of people in China are facing today. One of the statistics or factoids we mentioned in the piece is that at a recent sort of political conference, there was one official who had raised his concern and sort of was opining that, you know, the vast majority of Chinese people, their lives aren't actually that much better than it was 40 years ago. And that's in part due to this widening wealth gap.
I remember seeing in your piece that the Gini coefficient was like 50 and...
0.5,
sorry, but... And anything over 40 is the United Nations looks at that as like a red flag. And I couldn't help but notice also the United States was over that 0.45.
Right.
So there's a lot more in common
with the U.S. and Chinese economies than we may think, and soon maybe with this natural gas boom.
I definitely agree with that. I think, you know, the fact that we saw these Occupy protests that really kind of swept over the U.S. Some time ago, and now the protests that we're seeing really erupt in Hong Kong, you know, there are definitely some parallels there that it's hard not to notice. But I definitely think, you know, there has been some research done on reasons why people are protesting, and the environment is a major factor in that. So I think, you know, as time goes on, we'll have to see whether or not pollution is the kind of factor that pushes this over the edge, and what the edge means, you know, who really knows. But, you know, it's certainly going to play a role, if not the role.
You know, I think thinking about China in terms of tipping points and that kind of thing, maybe going down the wrong path, because I think China, it's kind of incomparable in the way that there's no civil society, right? There's no rights to demonstrate or to protest. There's no ability for villagers to voice their concerns. And when they do, they're haunted by this kind of dark undercurrent of threats and of intimidation by officials. People go disappearing all the time. You know, we can sort of be negative about the way that the Occupy protests were treated in the United States, but it's certainly nowhere near as brutal or as oppressive as the way that the authorities deal with protest and civil unrest in China on a daily basis. There's just simply no political freedom and no comparable political freedoms between the two systems. And so while I think there is a kind of issue of inequality in both countries, the way that civil society is developed to deal with those problems is extraordinarily different. And so I think along with an environmental movement, far more importantly for Chinese people and the people that we spoke to, was a sense of justice, right? Having their grievances be known, having the rule of law be adhered to, having petitions be read, having an independent judiciary. All of those things need to accompany environmentalism for environmentalism to be successful in China in any way. And, you know, when we spoke to villagers, they didn't see themselves as environmentalists. You know, this is quite a Western idea, I think, developed in the West, where there's a civil society that can enact certain rights and responsibilities within their governments. In China, it's far more, you know, in my opinion, about being heard and being respected under the rules that they have, and then having the, you know, not being subjugated into a kind of system which can swallow people whole. And so I think on that front, fracking could be really quite dangerous in China, just in the same way that any other industry is dangerous in China, in the sense that people's rights can just be very easily violated.
And from a policy standpoint, a lot of the policies that the Chinese senior leadership has taken over the last several decades has been focused on this endless pursuit of growth. Could China's shale boom, natural gas, shale deposits, somehow be able to satisfy these demands for endless growth? Or do you think that ultimately the senior leadership needs to kind of decouple growth as one of those barometers for success?
I think it's really difficult to know exactly what the leadership in China, how they will have this complex algorithm between growth and stability and solving the environmental crisis. This is a kind of chimera of problems, and when you beat down one head, another ugly head rears its head. And to that effect, it's really unknown. Like, how do you keep growing and satisfy a population plus keep pollution down? It's a really difficult problem to deal with, and they're going to really have to struggle with that in the same way that they struggled with poverty alleviation over the last 30 years. You know, they made a promise to their people when they were opening up that your lives are going to get better. Right? This was the grand bargain that they gave the Chinese people. Keep us in power and, you know, we're going to make your lives better. They've done a lot of poverty alleviation. How do they do the same thing in the next 20 years that they've done in the last 20 years whilst keeping the public happy? We just don't know at this point, I think. And whether or not fracking can alleviate some of that possibly, but it looks like the growth is so out of control that even that's going to just scrape the surface of the problem.
It's a really tough question, right? And I think one of our sources put it very well, which is that what we're seeing in China right now is kind of this race between how bad things are going to get and how quickly they need to continue to grow. And I think that's very much the case. I think in the past few decades, we have seen the Chinese leadership introduce a series of measures, you know, in the interest of the environment that's, you know, take it as you will, if it's just doing lip service to environmental causes, or if there's a legitimate concern around environmental pollution, to stem it back while somehow not slowing down growth too significantly. That said, I think even now, the way law enforcement has worked in China is it's very much of a top-down system still. And even within that, it's really the incentives at the local level that matter. And I think even with these pro-environment measures that have come into place, you know, let's see, now we're in 2014, you know, decades ago, and it wasn't until the late 90s or so that we saw an environmental protection ministry, which has, you know, made some notable strides in kind of introducing various environmental standards and water protection measures. I think just this past year or so, we're seeing that in addition to economic growth quotas that local officials, leaders have to meet, there are also, you know, environmental protection quotas that they have to meet. I think, though, the picture does change a bit still when you get down to the town level, to the village level, where the incentives are still very much in the interest of growing the local economy. And I think, as James said, that all really kind of stems from this grand bargain that the Communist Party struck with its people many years ago. And so I think that's exactly right. You know, we'll really have to see. There's a really interesting and important tension building in China right now, and where that will really lead remains to be seen.
One more night to go. One more sleep upon your burning banks. A greedy man never knows what he's done. A natural beauty should be
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jaya Lee and James West. They have a recent piece in Mother Jones on China and its fracking boom. So maybe you can talk about some of the relationships that have been born out of shale deposits, not only in China, but also in this country with these major multinational oil and gas interests. For example, the state-owned oil corporation, China National Petroleum Corporation, CNPC, they're a huge multinational player in this industry as well. They have investments in the U.S. Maybe you can talk about what you learned in this, in your research for this piece.
So in the initial stages of our reporting, you know, for example, when we had first gone out to China, and we kind of started out at this bilateral government-to-government oil and gas conference, which has been going on for the last 13 or so years. And as James mentioned earlier, kind of very recently turned its focus more towards fracking and unconventional gas, of which fracking is required to extract. And we saw all the major players there, from Halliburton to Shell to Chevron, ExxonMobil, Hess. You name kind of your major favorite multinational oil and gas company, and they were there, and
an all-star team.
Yeah, exactly. All the big players.
All eating noodles alongside their Chinese counterparts. It was really interesting to watch.
Yeah, and so there is a clear interest in whether that's driven by the profit potential for this. But there, you know, that's to say that there's already this diplomatic relationship in place where it's not quite news that these companies on the U.S. side, the international side, and the Chinese national oil companies have been coming together for years now.
So how did these relationships get catalyzed? Were they by corporations or was it on a governmental level?
I think the exact origin of where this relationship was born is kind of intangible. It's kind of hard to put your finger on that. But from our research, what we've been able to gather is that it was initiated somewhat from the Chinese government and from the U.S. government, kind of seeing this technology really become a mainstay in the U.S. national energy landscape was something of an inspiration to China's leaders. On top of that, you had this bilateral forum that was happening for the last 13 years or so that was focused on oil and gas and building relationships in the private sector and public sector. And so in 2009, you had Obama and then President Hu Jintao sign a bilateral shale gas agreement between the U.S. and China. About a year later, we also saw a global shale gas initiative launched by the State Department. And so, look, I mean, China's just one example of the U.S. attempting to export this technology around the world, really. And how much traction it's gotten, I think, is up for debate. But in China, it seems to be playing out fairly well. So that's sort of where that all began.
You talk about this technology. Mm-hmm. How transferable is it when we consider the differences in the shale deposits themselves and their needs for water and the availability of water in China versus in places like in the U.S.?
We have asked this question when we were out in China. We posed this question to a number of oil executives and sort of investors even. And I think one of the reactions we got that was somewhat common was that, you know, I think a lot of investors and these companies thought that the technology was going to be way more applicable than it turned out to be. I think they're kind of learning the challenges along the way, and there were some very immediate issues that arose kind of almost as soon as they hit the ground in China. You know, the terrain is completely different, the seismicity. Sichuan province, which is a pretty seismically active region, is kind of the current frontier for the fracking boom in China right now. And so I think there are just many different geological factors that weren't necessarily foreseen. I don't think that the private sector necessarily thinks that these are not, that these issues are insurmountable. But I think it's an ongoing experiment, which is quite interesting.
A big thanks to James West and Jay Lee from Mother Jones. Tune in next week on SeaChange Radio to listen to the second part of my interview with them.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Diodata, The Grateful Dead, and Neil Young. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.